often of that idea. Bill W. thought there might be a place for LSD therapy in AA, but his colleagues on the board of the fellowship strongly disagreed, believing that to condone the use of any mind-altering substance risked muddying the organization's brand and message. Sidney Cohen and his colleagues in Los Angeles had, like the Canadian group, started out thinking that LSD was a psychotomimetic. But by the mid-1950s, Cohen, too, had come to question that model. Born in 1910 in New York City to Lithuanian Jewish immigrants, Cohen, who in photographs looks very distinguished, with thick white hair slicked back, trained in pharmacology at Columbia University and served in the U.S. Army Medical Corps in the South Pacific during World War II. It was in 1953, while working on a review article about chemically induced psychoses, a long-standing research interest, that Cohen first read about a new drug called LSD. Yet when Cohen finally tried LSD himself in October 1955, he, quote, was taken by surprise. Expecting to find himself trapped inside the mind of a madman, Cohen instead experienced a profound, even transcendent sense of tranquility, as if, quote, the problems and strivings, the worries and frustrations of everyday life had vanished. In their place was a majestic, sunlit, heavenly inner quietude. I seemed to have finally arrived at the contemplation of eternal truth. Whatever this was, he felt certain it wasn't a temporary psychosis. Betty Eisner wrote that Cohen came to think of it instead as something he called unsanity, a state beyond the control of the ego. As often happens in science when a theoretical paradigm comes under pressure of contrary evidence, the paradigm totters for a period of time as researchers attempt to prop it up with various amendments and adjustments, and then, often quite suddenly and swiftly, it collapses as a new paradigm rises to take its place. Such was the fate of the psychotomimetic paradigm in the mid-1950s. Certainly a number of volunteers were reporting challenging and sometimes even harrowing trips, but remarkably few were having the full-on psychosis the paradigm promised. Even poor Mr. Katz's 12 hours as a madman included passages of indescribable pleasure and insight that could not be overlooked. As it happened, the psychotomimetic paradigm was replaced not by one, but two distinct new theoretical models, the psycholytic and later the psychedelic model. Each was based on a different conception of how the compounds worked on the mind and therefore how they might best be deployed in the treatment of mental illness. The two models weren't at odds with each other exactly, and some researchers explored both at various times, but they did represent profoundly different approaches to understanding the psyche, as well as to psychotherapy and ultimately science itself. The so-called psycholytic paradigm was developed first and proved especially popular in Europe and with the Los Angeles group identified with Sidney Cohen, Betty Eisner, and Oscar Janiger. Coined by an English psychiatrist named Ronald Sanderson, psycholytic means mind-loosening, which is what LSD and psilocybin seem to do, at least at low doses. Therapists who administer doses of LSD as low as 25 micrograms, and seldom higher than 150 micrograms, reported that their patients' ego defenses relaxed, allowing them to bring up and discuss difficult or repressed material with relative ease. This suggested that the drugs could be used as an aid to talking therapy because at these doses, the patient's egos remain sufficiently intact to allow them to converse with the therapist and later recall what was discussed. The supreme virtue of the psycholytic approach was that it meshed so neatly with the prevailing modes of psychoanalysis, a practice that the drugs promised to speed up and streamline rather than revolutionize or render obsolete. The big problem with psychoanalysis is that access to the unconscious mind on which the whole approach depends is difficult and limited to two less than optimal routes, the patient's free associations and dreams. Freud called dreams the royal road to the subconscious, bypassing the gates of both the ego and the superego. Yet the road had plenty of ruts and potholes. Patients don't always remember their dreams, and when they do recall them, it is often imperfectly. Drugs like LSD and psilocybin promised a better route into the subconscious. Stanislav Grof, who trained as a psychoanalyst, found that under moderate doses of LSD, his patients would quickly establish a strong transference with the therapist, recover childhood traumas, give voice to buried emotions, and in some cases actually relive the experience of their birth. Our first trauma, and, Grof believed, following Otto Rank, a key determinant of personality. Grof did extensive research trying to correlate his patients' recollections of their birth experience on LSD with contemporaneous reports from medical personnel and parents. He concluded that with the help of LSD, many people can indeed recall the circumstances of their birth, especially when it was a difficult one. In Los Angeles, Cohen, Eisner, and Janiger began incorporating LSD in their weekly therapeutic sessions, gradually stepping up the dose each week until their patients gained access to subconscious material, such as repressed emotions and buried memories of childhood trauma. They mainly treated neurotics and alcoholics and people with minor personality disorders, the usual sorts of patients seen by psychotherapists, functional and articulate people with intact egos and the will to get better. The Los Angeles group also treated hundreds of painters, composers, and writers on the theory that if the wellspring of creativity was the subconscious, LSD would expand one's access to it. These therapists and their patients expected the drug to be therapeutic, and lo and behold, it frequently was. Cohen and Eisner reported that 16 of their first 22 patients showed marked improvement. A 1967 review article summarizing papers about psycholytic therapy published between 1953 and 1965 estimated that the technique's rate of success ranged from 70% in cases of anxiety neurosis, 62% for depression, and 42% for obsessive-compulsive disorder. These results were impressive, yet there were few, if any, attempts to replicate them in controlled trials. By the end of the decade, psycholytic LSD therapy was routine practice in the tonier precincts of Los Angeles, such as Beverly Hills. Certainly the business model was hard to beat. Some therapists were charging upwards of $500 a session to administer a drug they were often getting from Sandoz for free. LSD therapy also became the subject of remarkably positive press attention. Articles like My 12 Hours as a Madman gave way to the enthusiastic testimonials of the numerous Hollywood celebrities who had had transformative experiences in the offices of Oscar Janiger, Betty Eisner, and Sidney Cohen, and a growing number of other therapists. Anais Nin, Jack Nicholson, Stanley Kubrick, Andre Previn, James Coburn, and the Beat comedian Lord Buckley all underwent LSD therapy, many of them on the couch of Oscar Janiger. But the most famous of these patients was Cary Grant, who gave an interview in 1959 to the syndicated gossip columnist Joe Hyams, extolling the benefits of LSD therapy. Grant had more than 60 sessions and by the end declared himself born again. All the sadness and vanities were torn away, the 55-year-old actor told Hyams, in an interview all the more surprising in light of Cary Grant's image as a reserved and proper Englishman. I've had my ego stripped away. A man is a better actor without ego, because he has truth in him. Now, I cannot behave untruthfully toward anyone, and certainly not to myself. From the sound of it, LSD had turned Cary Grant into an American. I'm no longer lonely, and I'm a happy man, Grant declared. He said the experience had allowed him to overcome his narcissism, greatly improving not only his acting, but his relationships with women. Young women have never before been so attracted to me. Not surprisingly, Grant's interview, which received boatloads of national publicity, created a surge in demand for LSD therapy and for just plain LSD. Hyams received more than 800 letters from readers eager to know how they might obtain it. Psychiatrists called, Hyams said, complaining that their patients were now begging them for LSD. If the period we call the 1960s actually began sometime in the 1950s, the fad for LSD therapy that Cary Grant unleashed in 1959 is one good place to mark a shift in the cultural breeze. Years before Timothy Leary became notorious for promoting LSD outside a therapeutic or research context, the drug had already been escaping from the lab in Los Angeles and receiving fervent national press attention. By 1959, LSD was showing up on the street in some places. Several therapists and researchers in Los Angeles and New York began holding LSD sessions in their homes for friends and colleagues, though exactly how these sessions could be distinguished from parties is difficult to say. At least in Los Angeles, the premise of doing research had become tenuous at best. As one of these putative researchers would later write, LSD became for us an intellectual fun drug. Sidney Cohen, who by now is the dean of LSD researchers in Los Angeles, scrupulously avoided this scene and began to have second thoughts about the drug, or at least about the way it was now being used and discussed. According to his biographer, the historian Stephen Novak, Cohen was made uncomfortable by the cultishness and aura of religiosity and magic that now wreathed LSD. Sounding a theme that would crop up repeatedly in the history of psychedelic research, Cohen struggled with the tension between the spiritual import of the LSD experience and the mystical inclinations it brought out in its clinical practitioners, and the ethos of science to which he was devoted. He remained deeply ambivalent. LSD, he wrote in a 1959 letter to a colleague, had opened a door from which we must not retreat merely because we feel uncomfortably unscientific at the threshold. And yet, that is precisely how the LSD work often made him feel, uncomfortably unscientific. Cohen also began to wonder about the status of the insights that patients brought back from their journeys. He came to believe that, quote, under LSD, the fondest theories of the therapist are confirmed by his patient. The expectancy effect was such that patients working with Freudian therapists returned with Freudian insights, framed in terms of childhood trauma, sexual drives, and Oedipal emotions, while patients working with Jungian therapists returned with vivid archetypes from the attic of the collective unconscious, and Ronkians with recovered memories of their birth traumas. This radical suggestibility posed a scientific dilemma, surely, but was it necessarily a therapeutic dilemma as well? Perhaps not. Cohen wrote that, quote, any explanation of the patient's problems, if firmly believed by both the therapist and the patient, constitutes insight or is useful as insight. Yet he qualified this perspective by acknowledging it was nihilistic, which, scientifically speaking, it surely was. For it takes psychotherapy perilously close to the world of shamanism and faith healing, a distinctly uncomfortable place for a scientist to be. And yet, as long as it works, as long as it heals people, why should anyone care? This is the same discomfort scientists feel about using placebos. It suggests an interesting way to think about psychedelics as a kind of active placebo, to borrow a term proposed by Andrew Weil in his 1972 book, The Natural Mind. They do something, surely, but most of what that is may be self-generated. Or, as Stanislav Grof put it, psychedelics are non-specific amplifiers of mental processes. Cohen's thoughtful ambivalence about LSD, which he would continue to feel until the end of his career, marks him as that rare figure in a world densely populated by psychedelic evangelists, the open-minded skeptic, a man capable of holding contrary ideas in his head. Cohen continued to believe in the therapeutic power of LSD, especially in the treatment of anxiety in cancer patients, which he wrote about enthusiastically for Harper's in 1965. There he called it therapy by self-transcendence, suggesting he saw a role in Western medicine for what would come to be called applied mysticism. Yet Cohen never hesitated to call attention to the abuses and dangers of LSD, or to call out his more fervent colleagues when they strayed too far off the path of science, the path from which the siren song of psychedelics would lure so many. Back in Saskatchewan, Humphrey Osmond and Abram Hoffer had taken a very different path after the collapse of the psychotomimetic paradigm, though this path too ended up complicating their own relationship to science. Struggling to formulate a new therapeutic model for LSD, they turned to a pair of brilliant amateurs, one a famous author, Aldous Huxley, and the other an obscure former bootlegger and gunrunner, spy, inventor, boat captain, ex-con, and Catholic mystic named Al Hubbard. These two most unlikely non-scientists would help the Canadian psychiatrist reconceptualize the LSD experience and develop the therapeutic protocol that is still in use today. The name for this new approach, and the name for this class of drugs that would finally stick, psychedelics, emerged from a 1956 exchange of letters between Humphrey Osman and Aldous Huxley. The two had first met in 1953, after Huxley wrote to Osman expressing interest in trying mescaline. He had read a journal article by Osman describing the drug's effects on the mind. Huxley had long harbored a lively interest in drugs and consciousness. The plot of his most famous novel, Brave New World, turns on a mind control drug he called Soma. As well as mysticism, paranormal, perception, reincarnation, UFOs, and so on. So in the spring of 1953, Humphrey Osman traveled to Los Angeles to administer mescaline to Aldous Huxley, though not without some trepidation. In advance of the session, he confided to a colleague that he did not, quote, relish the possibility, however remote, of finding a small but discreditable niche in literary history as the man who drove Aldous Huxley mad. He need not have worried. Huxley had a splendid trip, one that would change forever the culture's understanding of these drugs, when the following year he published his account of his experience in The Doors of Perception. It was without question the most extraordinary and significant experience this side of the beatific vision, Huxley wrote in a letter to his editor shortly after it happened. For Huxley, there was no question but that the drugs gave him access not to the mind of the madman, but to a spiritual realm of ineffable beauty. The most mundane objects glowed with the light of a divinity he called the mind at large. Even the folds of my gray flannel trousers were charged with isness, he tells us, before dilating on the beauty of the draperies in Botticelli's paintings and the allness and infinity of folded cloth. When he gazed upon a small vase of flowers, he saw what Adam had seen on the morning of his creation, the miracle moment by moment of naked existence, flowers shining with their own inner light and all but quivering under the pressure of the significance with which they were charged. Words like grace and transfiguration came to my mind. For Huxley, the drug gave him unmediated access to realms of existence usually known only to mystics and a handful of history's great visionary artists. This other world is always present, but in ordinary moments is kept from our awareness by the reducing valve of everyday waking consciousness, a kind of mental filter that admits only a measly trickle of the kind of consciousness we need in order to survive. The rest was a gorgeous superfluity, which, like poetry, men die every day for the lack thereof. Mescaline flung open what William Blake had called the doors of perception, admitting to our conscious awareness a glimpse of the infinite, which is always present all around us, even in the creases of our trousers, if only we could just see. Like every psychedelic experience before or since, Huxley's did not unfold on a blank slate, de novo, the pure product of the chemical, but rather was shaped in important ways by his reading and the philosophical and spiritual inclinations he brought to the experience. It was only when I typed his line about flowers shining with their own inner light and all but quivering under the pressure of their significance that I realized just how strongly Huxley had inflected my own perception of plants under the influence of psilocybin. The idea of a mental reducing valve that constrains our perceptions, for instance, comes from the French philosopher Henri Bergson. Bergson believed that consciousness was not generated by human brains, but rather exists in a field outside us, something like electromagnetic waves. Our brains, which he likened to radio receivers, can tune into different frequencies of consciousness. Huxley also believed that at the base of all the world's religions, there lies a common core of mystical experience he called the perennial philosophy. Naturally, Huxley's morning on mescaline confirmed him in all these ideas. As one reviewer of The Doors of Perception put it, rather snidely, the book contained 99% Aldous Huxley and only 0.5 gram mescaline. But it didn't matter. Great writers stamp the world with their minds, and the psychedelic experience will forevermore bear Huxley's indelible imprint. Whatever else it impressed on the culture, Huxley's experience left no doubt in his mind or Osmond's that the model psychosis didn't begin to describe the mind on mescaline or LSD, which Huxley would try for the first time 2 years later. One person's depersonalization could be another's sense of oneness. It was all a matter of perspective and vocabulary. It will give that elixir a bad name if it continues to be associated in the public mind with schizophrenia symptoms, Huxley wrote to Osmond in 1955. People will think they are going mad when in fact they are beginning, when they take it, to go sane. Clearly a new name for this class of drugs was called for, and in the 1956 exchange of letters, the psychiatrist and the writer came up with a couple of candidates. Surprisingly, however, it was the psychiatrist, not the writer, who had the winning idea. Huxley's proposal came in a couplet. To make this mundane world sublime, just half a gram of phenerothyme. His coinage combined the Greek words for spirit and manifesting. Perhaps wary of adopting such an overtly spiritual term, the scientist replied with his own rhyme. To fall in hell or soar angelic, you'll need a pinch of psychedelic. Osmond's neologism married two Greek words that together mean mind manifesting. Though by now the word has taken on the day-glow coloring of the 1960s, at the time it was the very neutrality of psychedelic that commended it to him. The word, quote, had no particular connotation of madness, craziness, or ecstasy, but suggested an enlargement and expansion of mind. It also had the virtue of being uncontaminated by other associations, though that would not remain the case for long. Psychedelic therapy, as Osmond and his colleagues practiced it beginning in the mid-1950s, typically involved a single, high-dose session, usually of LSD, that took place in comfortable surroundings, the subject stretched out on a couch with a therapist or two in attendance who say very little, allowing the journey to unfold according to its own logic. To eliminate distractions and encourage an inward journey, music is played and the subject usually wears eye shades. The goal was to create the conditions for a spiritual epiphany, what amounted to a conversion experience. But though this mode of therapy would become closely identified with Osmond and Hoffer, they themselves credited someone else for critical elements of its design, a man of considerable mystery with no formal training as a scientist or therapist, Al Hubbard. A treatment space decorated to feel more like a home than a hospital came to be known as a Hubbard room, and at least one early psychedelic researcher told me that this whole therapeutic regime, which is now the norm, should by all rights be known as the Hubbard method. Yet Al Hubbard, aka Captain Trips and the Johnny Appleseed of LSD, is not the kind of intellectual forebear anyone doing serious psychedelic science today is eager to acknowledge, much less celebrate. Al Hubbard is surely the most improbable, intriguing, and elusive figure to grace the history of psychedelics, and that's saying a lot. There is much we don't know about him, and many key facts about his life are impossible to confirm, contradictory, or just plain fishy. To cite one small example, his FBI file puts his height at 5 feet 11, but in photographs and videos, Hubbard appears short and stocky, with a big round head topped with a crew cut. For reasons known only to himself, he often wore a paramilitary uniform and carried a Colt 45 revolver, giving the impression of a small-town sheriff. But based on his extensive correspondence with colleagues and a handful of accounts in the Canadian press and books about the period, as well as interviews with a handful of people who knew him well, it's possible to assemble a rough portrait of the man, even if it does leave some important areas blurry or blank. Hubbard was born poor in the hills of Kentucky in either 1901 or 1902. His FBI file gives both dates. He liked to tell people he was 12 before he owned a pair of shoes. He never got past the third grade, but the boy evidently had a flair for electronics. As a teenager, he invented something called the Hubbard Energy Transformer, a new type of battery powered by radioactivity that could not be explained by the technology of the day. This, according to the best account we have of his life, a well-researched 1991 High Times article by Todd Brendan Fahey. Hubbard sold a half interest in the patent for $75,000, though nothing ever came of the invention, and Popular Science magazine once included it in a survey of technological hoaxes. During Prohibition, Hubbard drove a taxi in Seattle, but that appears to have been a cover. In the trunk of his cab, he kept a sophisticated ship-to-shore communication system he used to guide bootleggers seeking to evade the Coast Guard. Hubbard was eventually busted by the FBI and spent 18 months in prison on a smuggling charge. After his release from prison, the trail of Hubbard's life becomes even more difficult to follow, muddied by vague and contradictory accounts. In one of them, Hubbard became involved in an undercover operation to ship heavy armaments from San Diego to Canada and from there on to Britain in the years before the U.S. entered World War II, when the nation was still officially neutral. Scouts for the future OSS officer Alan Dulles, impressed by Hubbard's expertise in electronics, may or may not have recruited him for the mission. But when Congress began investigating the operation, Hubbard fled to Vancouver to avoid prosecution. There he became a Canadian citizen, founded a charter boat business, earning him the title of captain, and became the science director of a uranium mining company. According to one account, Hubbard had something to do with supplying uranium to the Manhattan Project. By the age of 50, the barefoot boy from Kentucky had become a millionaire, owner of a fleet of aircraft, a 100-foot yacht, a Rolls-Royce, and a private island off Vancouver. At some point during the war, Hubbard apparently returned to the United States, and he joined the OSS shortly before the wartime intelligence agency became the CIA. A few other curious facts about the pre-psychedelic Al Hubbard. He was an ardent Catholic with a pronounced mystical bent, and he was unusually flexible in his professional loyalties, working at various times as a run and gun runner, as well as an agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Was he a double agent of some kind? Possibly. At one time or another, he also worked for the Canadian Special Services, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Food and Drug Administration. His FBI file suggests he had links to the CIA during the 1950s, but the redactions are too heavy for it to reveal much about his role, if any. We know the government kept close tabs on the psychedelic research community all through the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, funding university research on LSD and scientific conferences in some cases, and it wouldn't be surprising if, in exchange for information, the government would allow Hubbard to operate with as much freedom as he did. But this remains speculation. Al Hubbard's life made a right-angled change of course in 1951. At the time, he was hugely successful but unhappy, desperately searching for meaning in life. This according to Willis Harmon, one of a group of Silicon Valley engineers to whom Hubbard would introduce LSD later in the decade. As Hubbard told the story to Harmon, and Harmon told it to Todd Brendan Fahey, he was hiking in Washington State when an angel appeared to him in a clearing. She told Al that something tremendously important to the future of mankind would be coming soon, and that he could play a role in it if he wanted to. But he hadn't the faintest clue what he was supposed to be looking for. The clue arrived a year later in the form of an article in a scientific journal describing the behavior of rats given a newly discovered compound called LSD. Hubbard tracked down the researcher, obtained some LSD, and had a literally life-changing experience. He witnessed the beginning of life on Earth, as well as his own conception. "It was the deepest mystical thing I've ever seen," he told friends later. "I saw myself as a tiny mite in a big swamp with a spark of intelligence. I saw my mother and father having intercourse." Clearly, this was what the angel had foretold, something tremendously important to the future of mankind. Hubbard realized it was up to him to bring the new gospel of LSD and the chemical itself to as many people as he possibly could. He had been given what he called a special chosen role. Thus began Al Hubbard's career as the Johnny Appleseed of LSD. Through his extensive connections in both government and business, he persuaded Sandoz Laboratories to give him a mind-boggling quantity of LSD. A liter bottle of it in one account, 43 cases in another, 6,000 vials in a third. He reportedly told Albert Hofmann he planned to use it to liberate human consciousness. Depending on whom you believe, he kept his supply hidden in a safe deposit box in Zurich or buried somewhere in Death Valley, but a substantial part of it he carried with him in a leather satchel. Eventually, Hubbard became the exclusive distributor of Sandoz LSD in Canada and later somehow secured an investigational new drug permit from the FDA, allowing him to conduct clinical research on LSD in the United States. This, even though he had a third-grade education, a criminal record, and a single, arguably fraudulent scientific credential. His PhD had been purchased from a diploma mill. Seeing himself as a catalytic agent, Hubbard would introduce an estimated 6,000 people to LSD between 1951 and 1966 in an avowed effort to shift the course of human history. Curiously, the barefoot boy from Kentucky was something of a mandarin, choosing as his subjects leading figures in business, government, the arts, religion, and technology. He believed in working from the top down and disdained other psychedelic evangelists like Timothy Leary, who took a more democratic approach. Members of parliament, officials of the Roman Catholic Church, Hollywood actors, government officials, prominent writers and philosophers, university officials, computer engineers, and prominent businessmen were all introduced to LSD as part of Hubbard's mission to shift the course of history from above. Not everyone Hubbard approached would play. J. Edgar Hoover, whom Hubbard claimed as a close friend, declined. Hubbard believed that if he could give the psychedelic experience to the major executives of the Fortune 500 companies, Abram Hoffer recalled, he would change the whole of society. One of the executives Hubbard turned on in the late 1950s, Myron Stolaroff, assistant to the president for long-term planning at Ampex, at the time a leading electronics firm in Silicon Valley, became convinced that Al Hubbard was the man to bring LSD to planet Earth. In 1953, not long after his psychedelic epiphany, Hubbard invited Humphrey Osmond to lunch at the Vancouver Yacht Club. Like so many others, Osmond was deeply impressed by Hubbard's worldliness, wealth, connections, and access to seemingly endless supplies of LSD. The lunch led to a collaboration that changed the course of psychedelic research and, in important ways, laid the groundwork for the research taking place today. Under the influence of both Hubbard and Huxley, whose primary interest was in the revelatory import of psychedelics, Osmond abandoned the psychotomimetic model. It was Hubbard who first proposed to him that the mystical experience many subjects had on a single high dose of mescaline or LSD might itself be harnessed as a mode of therapy, and that the experience was more important than the chemical. The psychedelic journey could, like the conversion experience, forcibly show people a new, more encompassing perspective on their lives that would help them to change. But perhaps Hubbard's most enduring contribution to psychedelic therapy emerged in, of all places, the treatment room. It is easier to accumulate facts about Al Hubbard's life than it is to get a steady sense of the character of the man. It was so rife with contradiction. The pistol-packing tough guy was also an ardent mystic who talked about love and the heavenly beatitudes. And the well-connected businessman and government agent proved to be a remarkably sensitive and gifted therapist. Though he never used those terms, Hubbard was the first researcher to grasp the critical importance of set and setting in shaping the psychedelic experience. He instinctively understood that the white walls and fluorescent lighting of the sanitized hospital room were all wrong. So he brought pictures and music, flowers and diamonds into the treatment room, where he would use them to prime patients for a mystical revelation or divert a journey when it took a terrifying turn. He liked to show people paintings by Salvador Dali and pictures of Jesus, or to ask them to study the facets of a diamond he carried. One patient he treated in Vancouver, an alcoholic paralyzed by social anxiety, recalled Hubbard handing him a bouquet of roses during an LSD session. He said, "Now hate them. They withered and the petals fell off, and I started to cry. Then," he said, "love them, and they came back, brighter and even more spectacular than before. That meant a lot to me. I realized that you can make your relationships anything you want. The trouble I was having with people was coming from me." What Hubbard was bringing into the treatment room was something well known to any traditional healer. Shamans have understood for millennia that a person in the depths of a trance or under the influence of a powerful plant medicine can be readily manipulated with the help of certain words, special objects, or the right kind of music. Hubbard understood intuitively how the suggestibility of the human mind during an altered state of consciousness could be harnessed as an important resource for healing, for breaking destructive patterns of thought, and proposing new perspectives in their place. Researchers might prefer to call this a manipulation of set and setting, which is accurate enough, but Hubbard's greatest contribution to modern psychedelic therapy was to introduce the tried and true tools of shamanism, or at least a westernized version of it. Within a few years, Hubbard had made the acquaintance of just about everybody in the psychedelic research community in North America, leaving an indelible impression on everyone he met, along with a trail of therapeutic tips and ampules of Sandoz LSD. By the late 1950s, he had become a kind of psychedelic circuit rider. One week he might be in Weyburn assisting Humphrey Osmond and Abram Hoffer in their work with alcoholics, which was earning them international attention. From there to Manhattan to meet with R. Gordon Wasson, and then a stop on his way back west to administer LSD to a VIP or check in on a research group working in Chicago. The next week might find him in Los Angeles conducting LSD sessions with Betty Eisner, Sidney Cohen, or Oscar Janiger, freely sharing his treatment techniques and supplies of LSD. Oscar Janiger recalled years later, "We waited for him like the little old lady on the prairie waiting for a copy of the Sears Roebuck catalog." And then it was back to Vancouver, where he had persuaded Hollywood Hospital to dedicate an entire wing to treating alcoholics with LSD. Hubbard would often fly his plane down to Los Angeles to discreetly ferry Hollywood celebrities up to Vancouver for treatment. It was this sideline that earned him the nickname Captain Trips. Hubbard also established two other alcoholism treatment facilities in Canada where he regularly conducted LSD sessions and reported impressive rates of success. LSD treatment for alcoholism using the Hubbard method became a business in Canada. But Hubbard believed it was unethical to profit from LSD, which led to tensions between him and some of the institutions he worked with because they were charging patients upwards of $500 for an LSD session. For Hubbard, psychedelic therapy was a form of philanthropy, and he drained his fortune advancing the cause. Al Hubbard moved between these far-flung centers of research like a kind of psychedelic honeybee, disseminating information, chemicals, and clinical expertise while building what became an extensive network across North America. In time, he would add Menlo Park and Cambridge to his circuit. But was Hubbard just spreading information, or was he also collecting it and passing it on to the CIA? Was the pollinator also a spy? It's impossible to say for certain. Some people who knew Hubbard, like James Fadiman, think it's entirely plausible, while others aren't so sure, pointing to the fact that the captain often criticized the CIA for using LSD as a weapon. "The CIA work stinks," he told Oscar Janiger in the late 1970s. Hubbard was referring to the agency's MK-Ultra research program, which since 1953 had been trying to figure out whether LSD could be used as a non-lethal weapon of war by, say, dumping it into an adversary's water supply, a truth serum in interrogations, a means of mind control, or a dirty trick to play on unfriendly foreign leaders, causing them to act or speak in embarrassing ways. None of these schemes panned out, at least as far as we know, and all reflected a research agenda that remains stuck on the psychotomimetic model long after other researchers had abandoned it. Along the way, the CIA dosed its own employees and unwitting civilians with LSD. In one notorious case that didn't come to light until the 1970s, the CIA admitted to secretly giving LSD to an Army biological weapons specialist named Frank Olson in 1953. A few days later, Olson supposedly jumped to his death from the 13th floor of the Statler Hotel in New York. Others believe Olson was pushed and that the CIA's admission, embarrassing as it was actually a cover-up for a crime far more heinous. It could be Olson whom Al Hubbard was referring to when he said, "I tried to tell them how to use it, but even when they were killing people, you couldn't tell them a goddamn thing." A regular stop on Hubbard's visits to Los Angeles was the home of Aldous and Laura Huxley. Huxley and Hubbard had formed the most unlikely of friendships after Hubbard introduced the author to LSD and the Hubbard Method in 1955. The experience put the author's 1953 mescaline trip in the shade. As Huxley wrote to Osman in its aftermath, "What came through the closed door was the realization, the direct total awareness from the inside, so to say, of love as the primary and fundamental cosmic fact." The force of this insight seemed almost to embarrass the writer in its baldness. The words, of course, have a kind of indecency and must necessarily ring false, seem like twaddle, but the fact remains. Huxley immediately recognized the value of an ally as skilled in the ways of the world as the man he liked to call the good captain. As so often seems to happen, the man of letters became smitten with the man of action. "What babes in the woods we literary gents and professional men are," Huxley wrote to Osmond about Hubbard. "The great world occasionally requires your services, is mildly amused by mine, but its full attention and deference are paid to uranium and big business. So what extraordinary luck that this representative of both these higher powers should A, have become so passionately interested in mescaline, and B, be such a very nice man." Neither Huxley nor Hubbard was particularly dedicated to medicine or science, so it's not surprising that over time their primary interest would drift from the treatment of individuals with psychological problems to a desire to treat the whole of society. This aspiration seems eventually to infect everyone who works with psychedelics, touching scientists too, including ones as different in temperament as Timothy Leary and Roland Griffiths. But psychological research proceeds person by person and experiment by experiment. There is no real-world model for using a drug to change all of society, as Hubbard and Huxley determined to do, with the result that the scientific method began to feel to them, as it later would to Leary, like a straitjacket. In the wake of his first LSD experience, Huxley wrote to Osmond, suggesting that, quote, "Who, having once come to the realization of the primordial fact of unity and love, would ever want to return to experimentation on the psychic level? My point is that the opening of the door by mescaline or LSD is too precious an opportunity, too high a privilege, to be neglected for the sake of experimentation, or to be limited to sick people." Osmond was actually sympathetic to this viewpoint. After all, he had administered mescaline to Huxley, hardly a controlled experiment, and he participated in many of Hubbard's sessions turning on the best and brightest. But Osmond wasn't prepared to abandon science or medicine for whatever Huxley and Hubbard imagined might lay beyond it. In 1955, Al Hubbard sought to escape the scientific straitjacket and formalize his network of psychedelic researchers by establishing something he called the Commission for the Study of Creative Imagination. The name reflected his own desire to take his work with psychedelics beyond the limits of medicine and its focus on the ill. To serve on the commission's board, Hubbard recruited Osmond, Hoffer, Huxley, and Cohen, as well as half a dozen other psychedelic researchers, a philosopher, Gerald Hurd, and a UN official. He named himself Scientific Director. What did these people think of Hubbard and his grandiose title, not to mention his phony academic credentials? They were at once indulgent and full of admiration. After Betty Eisner wrote a letter to Osmond expressing discomfort with some of Hubbard's representations, he suggested she think of him as a kind of Christopher Columbus. Explorers have not always been the most scientific, excellent, or wholly detached people, Osmond wrote her. It isn't clear how much more there was to the Commission for the Study of Creative Imagination than a fancy letterhead, but its very existence signaled a deepening fissure between the medical and the spiritual approach to psychedelics. Sidney Cohen, ever ambivalent on questions of science versus mysticism, abruptly resigned in 1957, only a year after joining the board. His title as scientific director notwithstanding, Hubbard himself said during this period, "My regard for science as an end within itself is diminishing as time goes on. When the thing I want with all of my being is something that lies far outside and out of reach of empirical manipulation." Long before Leary, the shift in the objective of psychedelic research from psychotherapy to cultural revolution was well underway. One last node worth visiting in Al Hubbard's far-flung psychedelic network is Silicon Valley, where the potential for LSD to foster creative imagination and thereby change the culture received its most thorough test to date. Indeed, the seeds that Hubbard planted in Silicon Valley continue to yield interesting fruit in the form of the Valley's ongoing interest in psychedelics as a tool for creativity and innovation. As I write, the practice of microdosing, taking a tiny, subperceptual regular dose of LSD as a kind of mental tonic, is all the rage in the tech community. Steve Jobs often told people that his experiments with LSD had been one of his two or three most important life experiences. He liked to taunt Bill Gates by suggesting he'd be a broader guy if he had dropped acid once or gone off to an ashram when he was younger. Gates has said he did, in fact, try LSD. It might not be a straight one, but it is possible to draw a line connecting Al Hubbard's arrival in Silicon Valley with his satchel full of LSD to the tech boom that Steve Jobs helped set off a quarter century later. The key figure in the marriage of Al Hubbard and Silicon Valley was Myron Stolaroff. Stolaroff was a gifted electrical engineer who, by the mid-1950s, had become assistant to the president for strategic planning at Ampex, one of the first technology companies to set up shop in what, at the time, was a sleepy valley of farms and orchards. It wouldn't be called Silicon Valley until 1971. Ampex, which at its peak had 13,000 employees, was a pioneer in the development of reel-to-reel magnetic tape for both audio and data recording. Born in Roswell, New Mexico in 1920, Stolaroff studied engineering at Stanford and was one of Ampex's very first employees, a fact that would make him a wealthy man. Nominally Jewish, he was by his 30s a spiritual seeker whose path eventually led him to Gerald Hurd, the English philosopher and friend of Aldous Huxley's. Stolaroff was so moved by Hurd's description of his LSD experience with Al Hubbard that in March 1956, he traveled to Vancouver for a session with the captain in his apartment. 66 micrograms of Sandoz LSD launched Stolaroff on a journey by turns terrifying and ecstatic. Over the course of several hours, he witnessed the entire history of the planet from its formation through the development of life on Earth and the appearance of humankind, culminating in the trauma of his own birth. This seems to have been a common trajectory of Hubbard-guided trips. "That was a remarkable opening for me," he told an interviewer years later, "a tremendous opening. I relived a very painful birth experience that had determined almost all my personality features. But I also experienced the oneness of mankind and the reality of God. I knew that from then on, I would be totally committed to this work. After that first LSD experience, I said, this is the greatest discovery man has ever made." Stolaroff shared the news with a small number of his friends and colleagues at Ampex. They began meeting every month or so to discuss spiritual questions and the potential of LSD to help individuals, healthy individuals, realize their full potential. Don Allen, a young Ampex engineer, and Willis Harmon, a professor of electrical engineering at Stanford, joined the group, and Al Hubbard began coming down to Menlo Park to guide the members on psychedelic journeys and then train them to guide others. As a therapist, Stolaroff recalled, he was one of the best. Convinced of the power of LSD to help people transcend their limitations, Stolaroff tried for a time, with Hubbard's help, to reshape Ampex as the world's first psychedelic corporation. Hubbard conducted a series of weekly workshops at headquarters and administered LSD to company executives at a site in the Sierra. But the project foundered when the company's general manager, who was Jewish, objected to the images of Christ, the Virgin Mary, and the Last Supper that Hubbard insisted on bringing into his office. Around the same time, Willis Harmon shifted the focus of his teaching at Stanford, offering a new class on the human potential that ended with a unit on psychedelics. The engineers were getting religion. And have it still. I know of one Bay Area tech company today that uses psychedelics in its management training. A handful of others have instituted microdosing Fridays. In 1961, Stolaroff left Ampex to dedicate himself full-time to psychedelic research. With Willis Harmon, he established the orotundly titled International Foundation for Advanced Study, IFAS, to explore the potential of LSD to enhance human personality and creativity. Stolaroff hired a psychiatrist named Charles Savage as medical director and, as staff psychologist, a first-year graduate student by the name of James Fadiman. Fadiman, who graduated from Harvard in 1960, was introduced to psilocybin by Richard Alpert, though not until after his graduation. "The greatest thing in the world has happened to me," Alpert told his former student, "and I want to share it with you." Don Allen also left his engineering post at Ampex to join IFAS as a screener and guide. The foundation secured a drug research permit from the FDA and a supply of LSD and mescaline from Al Hubbard and began, to use an Al Hubbard term, processing clients. Over the next 6 years, the foundation would process some 350 people. As James Fadiman and Don Allen recall those years at the foundation, both sat for extensive interviews, it was a thrilling and heady time to be working on what they were convinced was the frontier of human possibility. For the most part, their experimental subjects were healthy normals, or what Fadiman described as a healthy neurotic outpatient population. Each client paid $500 for a package that included before and after personality testing, a guided LSD session, and some follow-up. Al Hubbard would float in and out, Don Allen recalls. He was both our inspiration and our resident expert. James Fadiman says he was the hidden force behind the Menlo Park research. From time to time, Hubbard would take members of the staff to Death Valley for training sessions in the belief that the primordial landscape there was particularly conducive to revelatory experience. In half a dozen or so papers published in the early 1960s, the Foundation's researchers reported some provocative results. 78% of clients said the experience had increased their ability to love, 71% registered an increase in self-esteem, and 83% said that during their sessions they had glimpsed a higher power or ultimate reality. Those who had such an experience were the ones who reported the most lasting benefits from their session. Don Allen told me that most clients emerged with notable and fairly sustainable changes in beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors, way above statistical probability. Specifically, they became much less judgmental, much less rigid, more open, and less defended. But it wasn't all sweetness and light. Several clients abruptly broke off marriages after their sessions, now believing they were mismatched or trapped in destructive patterns of behavior. The foundation also conducted studies to determine if LSD could in fact enhance creativity and problem solving. This wasn't at all obvious, James Fadiman points out, since the experience is so powerful, you might just wander off and lose track of what you were trying to accomplish. So, to test their hypothesis, Fadiman and his colleagues started with themselves, seeing if they could design a credible creativity experiment while on a relatively light dose of LSD, 100 micrograms. Perhaps not surprisingly, they determined that they could. Working in groups of four, James Fadiman and Willis Harmon administered the same dose of LSD to artists, engineers, architects, and scientists, all of whom were somehow stuck in their work on a particular project. "We used every manipulation of set and setting in the book," Fadiman recalled, telling subjects they would be fascinated by their intellectual capacities and would solve problems as never before. Subjects reported much greater fluidity in their thinking, as well as an enhanced ability to both visualize a problem and recontextualize it. "We were amazed, as were our participants, at how many novel and effective solutions came out of our sessions," Fadiman wrote. Among their subjects were some of the visionaries who in the next few years would revolutionize computers, including William English and Doug Engelbart. During his LSD session, Engelbart invented a tinkle toy to toilet train children, or at least boys, a water wheel floating in a toilet that could be powered by a stream of urine. He went on to considerably more significant accomplishments, including the computer mouse, the graphical computer interface, text editing, hypertext, networked computers, email, and video conferencing, all of which he demonstrated in a legendary mother of all demos in San Francisco in 1968. There are all sorts of problems with Fadiman's study, It was not controlled, it relied on the subject's own assessments of their success, and it was halted before it could be completed, but it does at least point to a promising avenue for research. The foundation had closed up shop by 1966, but Hubbard's work in Silicon Valley was not quite over. In one of the more mysterious episodes of his career, Hubbard was called out of semi-retirement by Willis Harmon in 1968. After IFAS disbanded, Harmon had gone to work at the Stanford Research Institute, SRI, a prestigious think tank affiliated with Stanford University and a recipient of contracts from several branches of the federal government, including the military. Harmon was put in charge of SRI's Educational Policy Research Center, with a mandate to envision education's future. LSD by now was illegal, but still very much in use in the community of engineers and academics in and around Stanford. Hubbard, who by now was broke, was hired as a part-time special investigative agent, ostensibly to keep tabs on the use of drugs in the student movement. Harmon's letter of employment to Hubbard is both obscure and suggestive. "Our investigations of some of the current social movements affecting education indicate that the drug use prevalent among student members of the New Left is not entirely undesigned. Some of it appears to be present as a deliberate weapon aimed at political change. We are concerned with assessing the significance of this as it impacts on matters of long-range educational policy. In this connection, it would be advantageous to have you considered in the capacity of a special investigative agent who might have access to relevant data which is not ordinarily available." Though not mentioned in the letter, Hubbard's services to SRI also included using his extensive government contacts to keep contracts flowing. So Al Hubbard once again donned his khaki security guard uniform, complete with gold badge, sidearm, and a belt studded with bullets, and got back to work. But the uniform and the special agent title were all a cover, and an audacious one at that. As a vocal enemy of the rising counterculture, it's entirely possible Hubbard did investigate illegal drug use on campus for SRI or others, but if he did, he was once again working both sides of the street. Hubbard hated the idea of street acid and the counterculture's use of it. According to Don Allen, he played a role in at least one bust of an important underground LSD chemist in 1967. Hubbard sent Don Allen to a meeting to pose as a Canadian buyer looking to purchase pure LSD from a Bay Area group that included the notorious LSD chemist and Grateful Dead sound engineer, Owsley Stanley III. Federal agents tailed the people at the meeting back to Stanley and his lab in Orinda, California. During the bust, they reportedly found 350,000 doses of LSD. But though the legal status of LSD had changed by 1968, Hubbard and Harmon's mission, to provide the LSD experience to political and intellectual leaders around the world, apparently had not. The work might well have continued, just more quietly and beneath the cover story. For as Willis Harmon told Todd Brendan Fahey in a 1990 interview, and as a former SRI employee confirmed, Al never did anything resembling security work. According to Harmon, Al's job was to run the special sessions for us. That former SRI employee is Peter Schwartz, an engineer who became a leading futurist. He is currently Senior Vice President for Government Relations and Strategic Planning at Salesforce.com. In 1973, Schwartz went to work for Willis Harmon at SRI, his first job out of graduate school. By then, Al Hubbard was more or less retired, and Schwartz was given his office. On the wall above the desk hung a large photograph of Richard Nixon, inscribed, "To my good friend Al, for all your years of service, your friend Dick." A pile of mail accumulated in the inbox with letters addressed to A.M. Hubbard from all over the world, including, he recalled, one from George Bush, the future CIA director, who at the time was serving as head of the Republican National Committee. Who was this fellow, Schwartz wondered. And then one day this round fellow with a gray crew cut, dressed in a security guard's uniform and carrying a .38, showed up to retrieve his mail. "I'm a friend of Willis's," Hubbard told Schwartz. And then he began asking me the strangest questions, completely without context. "Where do you think you actually came from? What do you think about the cosmos?" I learned later this was how he checked people out to decide whether or not you were a worthy candidate. Intrigued, Schwartz asked Harmon about this mystery man, and piece by piece began to put together much of the tale of Hubbard's life. The young futurist soon realized that most of the people I was meeting who had interesting ideas had tripped with Hubbard. Professors at Stanford, Berkeley, the staff at SRI, computer engineers, scientists, writers, and all of them had been transformed by the experience. Schwartz said that several of the early computer engineers relied on LSD in designing circuit chips, especially in the years before they could be designed on computers. You had to be able to visualize a staggering complexity in three dimensions, Schwartz told me. Hold it all in your head. They found that LSD could help. Schwartz eventually realized that everyone in that community